come in with all of my fine Irish good looks and me fine blue eyes and my good Canadian accent. And I could flash my enrollment card, but I'm a tribal member. The topic tonight seems somewhat frivolous, but really it helps to define some of the basic problems that Indian people in the Americas, and I mean both North and South America, face today. And it is a problem of status and identity, both to themselves and to all the other people they have to live with in the Western Hemisphere. Now, I've basically got about 15 years under my belt in working with Indian education. I've worked in a lot of communities, mostly here in the United States, but also in Canada. And I've a master's in ed, and another in political science, and I'm now a newly minted school district administrator, but a longtime history teacher and art teacher. But most of the time, I've been working with Indian programs, with Indian children, and I'm Scottish and Irish, and mostly French. And the second biggest quantity of blood is Haudenosaunee, which is Iroquois. And my family are from a little town called Oswiecan on the Grand River. It's about 60 miles from Niagara Falls on the north side of Lake Erie. And I've been here in Washington for 20 years as a resident, and I've married a darling wife who is a native of this place. And I have a whole passel of daughters. And some people seem to think I'm qualified to talk about this subject. So, first of all, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. When you say American Indian or Native American or Indian or whatever terminology you might use, what are the images that pop into your heads? Can I have some of the upfront, brave, type A personalities just come on and lay out their mental images?
Living with nature.
Living with nature. Okay.
Somebody with a feathered headdress.
Yeah. Okay.
Poverty.
The guy on the nickel.
Hey, he was a Seneca, even though they made him look like a Sioux, like a Lakota. Others?
Indian Wars,
yeah. Ooh, and the cowboys and the Indians and the cavalry coming to the rescue.
Indian dances.
Powwow?
Yeah.
Indian dances, yeah.
Black Hills.
Pardon?
Black Hills.
Black Hills, yeah.
Pueblos and sheep.
Pueblos and sheep. I heard something over here.
Segregated?
Reservations.
Reservations. Big word.
Alcoholism?
Yeah.
Bingo.
Fireworks. Another good one.
Fishing.
Ah, I was waiting for that one. Fishing.
Spear fishing.
From Minnesota by any chance?
Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, same area. We know what we're thinking about.
Yeah, we know.
Welders.
Okay.
Jewelry.
Iron workers. We're going to get to that. Yeah. I like your image better.
Yeah.
Jewelry. Okay.
Baskets.
Bison.
Buffaloes, bison.
Peace
pipes.
Totem poles.
Teepees.
Drums.
Pardon?
The drums.
Traditions, yeah.
Blankets.
Poetry.
Okay, poetry. When I was a little kid, one of the dilemmas that I had was trying to figure my image of what an Indian was to me as a little kid, and with what it seemed to be to everybody else that was around me. Totem poles were something that all those Indians did out west, and war bonnets were what all those Indians out west did, and they had buffalo out there, and I grew up with every stereotype that any non-Indian kid grows up with about all those Indians out west. That's not what Indian meant to me back east. I think you could pick a little kid up who grew in Taos Pueblo and he'd have say the same thing about the stereotypes of them other Indians up north. And if you went to Allard Bay and talked to a little Quaggiof boy and asked him what's his stereotype of Indians, he'd probably be lucky enough not to have much of a stereotype because they don't have any TVs in Allard Bay. Most of our images of Indians are made by media, and especially for those of us who are old enough to have grown up in the cowboy movie generations. And I guess the only thing to be said about those stereotypes is that Indian people have bought into them too. And what's happened is the reality of Indian people has changed from a very diverse group of people who are not culturally or linguistically or even racially related to one another. I'm going to blow some stereotypes tonight. Into a pan-Indianism. That's the term that's now used to describe an acceptable Indianness among other Indians that is universal. And there was no such thing, even in my grandmother's generation. Grandmother never thought of herself as Indian. She was Anishinaabe, and she was Haudenosaunee. And Indian was something out of a book. Okay? Now, I got to introduce you to some terminology here. And because I want to deal with the topic tonight in a very big picture, we need to look at what is an Indian in Canada, what is an Indian in the United States, what's an Indian in Latin America. And for that, let me give you some terms. I'm going to write them up here on the board. This is what the government and what the popular general public use when they refer to Indian people. And there's a couple of categories here that I'm going to, will hopefully make a point to you too. And Canada, all government documents still officially refer to Indians as Aboriginal natives. Aboriginal natives. I don't know why they're redundant, because Aboriginal means native. That's native. It's the British way. I'll just put Abo. How's that? And native. Okay. General public in most of Canada, let's go with Indian. You almost never hear Native American up there. That's a term that kind of grew out of the civil rights movement here in the United States. A lot of Indians resented being called Indians. I mean, after all, Columbus was lost. And but this is still a real common term among English-speaking peoples in Canada. And in French Canada, it's Indani. I-N-D-A-N-I. Okay? Now, second category, to further confuse these things, is there's another category of Native people in Canada. And these people are politely referred to as Métis. M-E-T-I-S. These are people who are of mixed marriages, breeds, mixed bloods. Okay? And in Canada, they have a very different legal status than people who are full bloods. Now, in the United States, of course, we've got Native American has become the nice, safe, universally acceptable probably the second most popular American Indian. And just plain Indian. What terms do we use for the second category for people of mixed ancestry?
Half-breed.
Yeah. Any other?
Is that also mulatto?
Pardon?
Is mulatto fit into
that? Nope.
Black.
Mixed blood is a term you see in the literature a lot. Mixed blood. Writers somehow, when people talk, half-breed's okay. When they write, somehow mixed blood becomes more comfortable. So we have mixed blood. Well, if you go south of the border, down there, anyone who is more than half Indian is just plain Indios. And it's the same in both the Spanish and Portuguese speaking countries. And then if you were a half breed or less, you were a matiz or a mestizo. Mestizo. Okay? Now, with all these terms, then another question that ought to be asked is, which country would you say, which of these areas of the Western Hemisphere would you say have the greatest difficulty in trying to find some comfortable way of dealing with Native peoples?
U.S.
probably first and Canada second, because of the greatest diversity of terms. I mean, nothing seems to quite fit comfortably. Which society seems to have the most callous or least caring or least disturbed at way of dealing with people who are Native? All of Latin America. Now, there's a corollary there. United States, we have at this time roughly 8 million enrolled tribal members, and we have another 4 million who are defined as Indian by the U.S. government for some reason, but who are not enrolled in the tribe. And there's another 8 million that are eligible for enrollment by one category or another, but for one reason or another can't be enrolled. For example, I have a little Indian girl in my school about 4 years ago. She's a full-blood Indian, which means she would be recognized by the government, she's eligible for enrollment and all this kind of thing, but she can't be enrolled because she's 1/16th of 16 different tribes. And she has to be at least 1/4 to enroll in any of them. Swear to God, this is true. Lord is my honest witness to that. Those things happen. Because part of the phenomena of her family is way back, they were more or less overwhelmed by an urbanized area in Illinois, and they have intermarried so much with other Indians who've come to work in the city that she's now a little of this, a little of that, a little of this, a little of that, and so on. That's a phenomenon that happens. In Canada, the numbers are relatively comparable with one big difference. Maybe 500,000 less. But the difference there is Canada's only got about 1/3 of our population, which makes the Indians in Canada a much more significant minority. In fact, they are the largest single minority in Canada. Here, American Indians are not the smallest, but among the smaller ones. And they seem to be pretty much considered a rather insignificant group, except when treaties are concerned and when there's land rights issues or fishing rights issues or whatever. Because the significant thing in American history about these Indians is that they have a contract with the government. Well, in Canada, some have a contract and some do not. And we'll discuss that a little later. Now, in Latin America, if you step across the border, Mexican census as of 88 officially recognized 16 million Indios. And if you go farther south, you come into populations that are 35 million or more, who are defined as Indians, not as mixed bloods. In countries like Peru, for example, it is 97% Indios. There are only 200,000 people in the country who are not native. However, one of the little aspects of Peru's history is that 200,000 people own and control everything. Okay? So part of the South American phenomena is we have a whole lot of Indians down here. And they are majority populations in many countries. Now, that's not entirely, that doesn't all hold true. In Argentina, the government does not recognize that there are any Indians. Mainly because in Argentina, they exterminated them. So you can't stereotype that most South Americans are Indian. Another aspect of this phenomenon in Latin America, of course, is the fact that most of those Indians are not what we would call enfranchised by their societies. They are usually second or third class citizens in some way or another. And yet they are the labor force that makes the country work, however well they work. One of the phenomena that we deal with in Latin America is the ongoing struggle of Indians who seem to have almost no existence as far as any official government recognition or relationships, still struggling to survive. One of the sidelights of the war in Nicaragua is the Indians stuck in the middle of it. And one of the other sidelights is that we are using Guatemala as one of our major allies in American support of the Contra movement in Nicaragua. But before the Contras had a nice safe border area, they had to go in and nearly exterminate a tribe. Basically kill anyone who wouldn't leave and force the rest out of an area. They demilitarized zone. And Guatemala has a terrible civil rights record with anybody who is not enfranchised in their society, and that's the majority of the Indians down there. But Guatemala is one of our allies, so we don't say those things in public, at least the government of the United States doesn't. How many Indians are there? Anyone make a guess how many Indians are around today in the world? American Indians? Let's say full bloods, let's say somebody who is over a quarter. Okay? That means they're Indian enough to where it's going to have a significant impact on their life.
100 million?
I see some nodding heads. It looks pretty good. It's kind of hard to get a perspective on that because Latin America, especially, and no, they're down there. But it's just sort of that big nameless face full of those Indian type faces down there. We don't know much about it. 257 million. It's just about exactly half the people in the Western Hemisphere are Indian. Quarter or more. Now, are Indians significant in the Western Hemisphere? Well, that's where the majority of the countries that still owe us money are. Okay? And that's where the majority of the forests are being cut down because nothing else in the economy works except slash and burn. Are they significant in the affairs of the future? If you like to breathe, they will be. If you know, America's economy could be pulled down very, very quickly with about three or four forfeitures down there. If those, some of the major countries like Brazil simply stopped paying on their debts, we'd be in very, very deep trouble. They could hurt you in your pocket. There's some major problems down there. They're just sort of floating along. And Indian people are intimately important to you and what happens to them down there. And of course, right here at home, one of the neat phenomena that's happening in the United States is the long struggle to educate ourselves has brought a lot of Indian people to the point where they're beginning to develop a consciousness of themselves as a people of a hemisphere. I know a great many Indians now who are far more educated about Latin American affairs than the average white person. Just because they understand how much that area means to us and the people. Yes, ma'am.
The term indigenous, when I was in El Salvador, we met with a group of indigenous
people.
Is that a term that's starting to be used down there or broader than there?
Indigenous? I'm hearing it, but then I'm in the States or in Canada picking up newspapers, for example, from Latin America and fumbling through them in my terrible Spanish, and trying to follow what's going on down there. But that doesn't mean that I can really put my finger on saying that that's becoming a more popular term.
There is a union of indigenous. That's the group.
That is a unique phenomenon.
Yeah.
There are also Indians who are now members of the United Nations, tribes that are now UN members. That happened in 73. Six tribes, three of them from the United States and three from Canada, took their last and most current treaties to the World Court. And essentially, they went to the World Court and asked the judges there, is there anything in this treaty with the British Crown or with the United States which gives up our sovereignty by world law, international law? And essentially, the World Court looked at them and said no. They then applied for membership. Now, this was done at a very, very tricky time, and a remarkable thing happened, because when you add up all the Latin American countries and North American countries that would have a stake in not letting Indians have any recognition in the UN, they actually got voted in. And then it was all vetoed by the Security Council. All it takes one country in the Security Council to veto any membership, and the Canada and the United States took care of that. However, they went in and actually got an override that's sort of an override. They have what's called associate membership, which simply means you can't vote in any political issues of the United Nations, but you have a seat. And right now, the Iroquois Six Nations, the Algonquin Nation, the Assiniboine Sioux of Canada, I'm trying to think of who else, now issue passports to their ambassadors, and they now travel to The Hague, and they now sit in on meetings, and they are becoming prime figures in this indigenous people's movement in the Western Hemisphere. And they're trying to advocate a really unique approach. It's the sort of we're all in this together approach. And unless we change what's been done to Native people in Latin America, we aren't going to be able to achieve any real change in North America either. And there's some very enlightened types of things going on right now in the UN in terms of Indian people. But that's all happened since 73. And again, all of this is totally unknown to the vast majority of American and Canadian citizens. As I can tell you, it didn't get in any of the papers. All right. Let's talk a little bit about who Indians used to be. And then we'll get down to the nitty-gritty about what the government and other agencies of power say Indians are. Okay? One of the nice things Just finishing another master's in grad school, I also took some more anthropology courses, and I've been really updated on some neat stuff. And there's some tremendous controversies going on right now that are very excited about the origins of Indian people. One of the neat things happening in anthropology is the study of human beings is now being augmented by our genetic knowledge and by all these wondrous machines like the electron microscope that have been basically evolving in the medical field, but which now have allowed us to understand our origins in some very new ways. You always think of the archaeologist as the fellow who's out there digging in the dirt. He's trying to measure different layers of soil, and he goes and if, you know, he goes out for a carbon 14 date at $150 to $400 a shot, and tries to date a rock or some chunk of leather or whatever. If it's very old, you're dating non-organic material with potassium argon. If it's new, you're dating carbon-based material with carbon 14. And then we think of the anthropologist as somebody like Margaret Mead, who's out there living with the natives, recording songs, writing down Indian legends, and whatever and whatever. That's not what anthropology is anymore. That's what it started to be. What's now evolved is a whole lot of anthropologists in many universities are not doing much of anything in the field. Part of the reason for that is there's very little money available nationwide. And the other reason is they need very, very large sums of money to go out and do extremely sophisticated testing of materials that they have. And they're now going back and looking on the shelves at artifacts and at human remains that have been around for a long time and that they already always figured they knew what they were. They'd already stereotyped that we've figured this one out. They're going back and looking on the shelves in museums and with the brand new technology that medicine's provided and finding out a lot of strange things. And this is not happening just in our country, but around the world. And a couple of the unique things that's come out of this is where do Indians fit into the family of mankind? Throughout the last 8 million years, there have always been at least 3 to 5 hominid species on the planet at one time. And for the majority of those 8 million years, they were all in Africa. And they all could have been our ancestors, but only one was. Essentially, the person who we could say was human enough to use fire and a lot of other basically more sophisticated types of technologies was that critter that's been labeled Homo erectus. Because when they first discovered remains of this person, they thought of him as the first upright walking true man, which was a total misnomer because now we realize that one of the keys to our survival is that our ancestors have been walking upright for a long, 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 long time. In fact, about the same time that during the same 2, 3, 4 million year period in which chimpanzees and gorillas left the trees and became semi-terrestrial and went into knuckle walking, there was another beastie who was developing, getting rid of the thumb on his foot so that he could walk and run. And that beastie became ancestor to the hominid line. And that upright walking goes back a long way. And that we're talking now about 18 million years. Homo erectus was the first human being, thinking, tool using, laughing, loving, scared, irrational type, normal human. Even though he had about a quarter less brain capacity than you do, of course maybe he used more of it. But he left Africa for the first time and moved into Asia and into Europe. And basically all we know at this point is that sometime about 300 1,000 years ago, a Western Asian European branch of his family evolved a very unique physical type, which we call Homo sapiens Neanderthalus. And essentially the difference with them is that they were quite a bit heavier than we are, and they were face dominant. That means that their brain, instead of being on top of their face, most of their brain being above their eyes, was behind their face. They had these long skulls. It's the same type of skull pattern that chimpanzees and gorillas have. Now, Homo erectus, their ancestor, didn't have it. So it means that this was a genetic trait in the family that suddenly that had gone away and then suddenly cropped up again. And they were pretty hefty, ladies and gentlemen. They weren't tall, but their bones were quite a bit heavier than ours. An average Neanderthal woman in, of, say, 25 would have massed in at 180. And a Neanderthal man, average of the same age, would have massed in at 200. And it was, if you imagine a people with arms and wrists like our thighs, these were a very hardy survivor types. And not very tall. A giant might be about 5'4". 5'6", but extremely physically fit, very tough people. And when they first discovered their bones in the 1870s in Europe in the Neanderthal Valley, they looked at them and said, "We found the missing link." I mean, they have these huge bones. They're like gorillas. Look at that skull. And yet they were people. And they were doing all the things people do. For a long time, scientists thought that they were our ancestors, and we found out that they really were, they were our cousins. They were a branch somewhere in Asia, and I'll go into another possibility that they might have been somewhere in the New World a little later on. But somewhere in Asia right now, this is the dominant theory that everybody's comfortable with. About 100,000 years ago, we show up, round heads instead of long heads. And we've got this big forehead up here. And we tend to be a little lighter build. We do some things differently. And essentially, out of Asia, about 60,000 years ago, two distinct races develop. And that's a race is a point I want to get at with all of this. In Africa, we had species differences. And some of the other man-like beings had two or three races. The Australopithecines were one branch of the human family where there were three distinct races living at the same time. But species difference is more than just color or body build or facial type or all of those kinds of things. Species difference means you've got some major genetic differences to the point where a human being of this species and a human being of that species would have trouble breeding. Okay? Species differences of that nature existed between Neanderthal and our ancestors, Homo sapiens sapiens. But there were mixed bloods. We found remains of some in the Middle East. Essentially, some point in Asia, our family split into two races. And the distinction of the races had nothing to do with color. It was their teeth. Yep. One of the neat things is that if you want to look at something you can use as a tag, a label, that you can look at all these human remains for a long period of time, you don't want to look at something as flighty as the color of your skin. And of course, skin doesn't last very well, but hair lasts for tens of thousands of years, so you could still find racial characters from that. You want to look at something that it doesn't change hardly at all, no matter what intermarriage occurs. You want a real, consistent, strong genetic characteristic. And our teeth haven't changed much at all in the last 60,000 years. And essentially, everyone on Earth has two types of teeth. There's the one human family, they're called cynodonts. Cynodonts originated in China, in North Central East Asia. And they have incisors in front of their mouths. They're chiseled. They have a hollow in the back of them. And some of you might notice that your front teeth kind of work like scissors a little bit, but some of us, they don't really match up. And cynodonts, they really, one, the bottom teeth fit into a socket in the top teeth. Also, cynodonts often have funny molars, little round things that are not in the front of the mouth, but in the back. They're called peg molars. And the other family, sundodonts, are people with teeth like you, because all of you, with the exception of a few Asians here, are probably sundodonts. And we know this originated, the sundodonts originated in Southeast Asia, and somehow or other, people with those genetic traits spread westward into the Middle East, and they spread westward into Europe, and in Europe, they basically overwhelmed, replaced, and in some places slaughtered and ate Neanderthals. And till Neanderthal became extinct. And almost all the people of the western part of the old world are sundodonts. The only exceptions are, remember the one of those great human flows, the Mongol invasions. You still find Poles and Finns and Laplanders who are sundodonts, because their ancestry goes directly to Northern Asia. Okay? Now, in the world today, the biggest population of sundodonts, that other race, is in Northern Asia, and all the Indians of the Americas are sundodonts. Okay? And then the sundodonts are everybody else. And that was the first real racial distinction in the human family of Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, with that kind of information, and then with the other genetic codes, reading the cell tissue in your bones, as long as that bone has not been fossilized and replaced with minerals, you can still read the amino acids, which will crystallize in a bone millions of years old. You can read those and you can determine the genetic characteristics of that person. And those can be used to tag people and to look at human populations and trace them from one place to another and how they change in a particular location over the years. And one of the things we found out when we looked at all those things is that some of the oldest bones in America, they're so old we've never been able to date them before. And that's always upset some anthropologists, because when Thomas Jefferson came, and he was an anthropologist, by the way, Thomas Jefferson loved digging up Indian graves, and he loved looking at old Indian village ruins, and he was really into mounds. The mound builders in the eastern United States fascinated him. And he did beautiful illustrations and drawings and books full of notes. In his time, everyone had the biblical perspective that Indians were the lost tribe of Israel. They'd all been here for about 12,000 years. Okay? And we've evolved from that. When I went to school, every textbook I ever had said, well, the Indians have been here for about 15,000 years. I'm talking about studying that stuff in the late 50s and early 60s. By the time I got to college, people were saying, now wait a minute, we've got some bones up in Alaska that have been carved elk femurs that have been made into fleshing tools and carved with designs on them that were carbon dated at 28,000 years. And so we said, well, okay, now we've got to look at about 30,000 years. Well, that game is a very dangerous game in any field studying human beings, because dates, when you publish a date and your name is on the document, you've kind of committed yourself to a theory. And if someone blows your theory, it discredits you. People build their careers in the social sciences around theories that get published, and they really hate it when someone upsets the apple cart. Somewhat like religion. Anyway, one of the outcomes of all of this is no one is really talking about dates anymore. We have a dilemma. Carbon 14 is basically gone by about 30,000 years ago, and with extremely sophisticated equipment, at $1,000 a shot, you can measure the traces that are left to about 60,000 years, and then it's all gone. And if you want to use potassium argon, which is the next dating method, it won't even measure anything less than 300,000 years old. So there's a tremendous gap. We have no way to radioactively or chemically date anything between 60,000 years ago and 300,000 years ago. It's all guesswork at that point. Okay? And every anthropologist in the field is uncomfortably aware of those limitations. And of course, remember I mentioned that money is an issue in anthropology now, and the expense of getting sophisticated scientific dating and testing techniques is really very large. Well, we've found a skull in California, for example, in Del Mar, that had no carbon 14 in it at all. Couldn't even find traces. Blew people away. Lewis Leakey, about 77. Lewis Leakey, I don't know if you know, many of you know him, he's considered one of the great revolutionary minds in American anthropology in the world. He's a white African. He was born and raised in Africa, in East Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania. And he is a brilliant anthropologist in Olduvai Gorge and all of these wonderful discoveries that have spread our understanding of ourselves and our roots so far back. We're basically done by Lewis and his wife, Mary, and by his son, Richard. Well, Lewis is dead now, but in 77 he came to California to a place called the Calico Hills. And they had some really difficult things to live with, some little chopper tools. And he said, basically, if I found these in Africa, I'd know they were Homo erectus. But since they were found in America, no one will ever believe it. And the dates were about 700,000 years. There are some other dates coming out of Brazil that are 300,000 years. The disturbing thing that all of this brings up is, okay, Homo erectus left Africa and went into Asia and Europe. So possibly he crossed another land bridge, because the one thing about the Ice Age, it was not all cold. The world, what we call the Ice Age, was a fluctuation of cold and warm and cold and warm and cold and warm. And essentially over the last 2 to 4 million years, and it's hard to date because the earlier glaciations in the world were more or less destroyed. The record of them is destroyed by the later glaciations. You just grind it all up into so much sand, and then how do you do things like dating? During that period of time, the world was a lot colder than it is now for a lot longer periods of time. And in many areas, significant portions of the world, about a third of the Earth north of the equator was covered with ice. A little less than that south of the equator. And these are the glacial periods. But in between them, things would warm up for 15,000 years, 40,000 years, in one case 130,000 years, and then it would get cold again. Which is why scientists today don't believe that we're really, can say with any certainty that we're out of the Ice Age. It hasn't been warm long enough to say that the glaciers aren't going to come back. Anyway, that great period of time which molded mankind into what we are, the trial by ice, there have been lots of times when, with the majority of the Earth's water stuck on the land in form of ice, the oceans dropped 300 or 400 feet. And then you can walk from Siberia to Alaska. It's all one big broad plain called, that they now are referring to as Beringia, because it's the Bering Sea. And it's very possible that earlier migrations could have occurred at earlier dates. One of the interesting little sidelights is that the horse didn't evolve in the old world. all the fossil record for horses showing their evolutionary development is in the New World. And at some ancient time, horses migrated out of North America into Asia. And then they became extinct in North America until the Spaniards brought them back. So funny things of that sort have been going on. And if animals could migrate, people could migrate. One of the interesting things, too, is that in many parts of Asia and in Europe, some of the earliest human remains seem to be strongly associated with horses. And some people have gone so far as to say, now wait a minute, maybe these two species, Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalus, maybe the sapiens sapient didn't start in Asia. Maybe he followed the horse out of North America, which would make every one of you a Native American. The bottom line is that the final word isn't in. And with all of this confusion, one thing has come about that the Indians have kind of gotten used to, and that is everybody's going to have their opinion and nobody's going to agree with anybody else. And so you more or less just have to ignore the books to some degree and take it with all with a grain of salt. And more people in the Indian community, there was a period of time, by the way, when Indians would go to books to find out about themselves because the anthropologists seemed to know so much more. And a lot of them are turning away now and asking grandmother, does she know anything? And sometimes grandmother knows more than the scientists give her credit for. Anyway, genetic data shows us that five distinct races of people were native to America when Columbus got here. And they come from essentially two different migrations. We have a group of people who originally were both Cynodont and Sundadont, but became Cynodont. That became the dominant trait through intermarrying, who came in here about 30 to 23,000 years ago on a land bridge. And they moved basically across Beringia, which at that time was kept pretty much ice-free by the Japanese current. The world spins the same direction. It means warm wind from the equator is going to come flashing up at the northwest. And it's going to do the same thing in the Atlantic where it hits Ireland. And it's going to mean wet and warm as opposed to dry and cold. And so Alaska was inhabitable. So was the Northwest Coast, and we know that they moved down the coastal plain. In some places, like the Queen Charlotte Islands in British Columbia, we have very old remains. Here in Washington State, I don't know how many of you are Washingtonians, but essentially if you went out to the mouth of the Columbia River and you wanted to go fishing in El Waco, in those days, even as recently as 15,000 years ago, you'd have to go another 150 miles west. Because there was a huge coastal plain out there that was all dry land and glacier free. Likewise, these proverbial jet streams and Japanese currents and all this kind of thing that hit the west coast of the continents drop their rain, and by the time they get over the Rocky Mountains, that air's gone up there and there's a dry place on the backside of the Rockies. And there's not enough precipitation to build any snow. Without enough snow, they don't build a lot of glaciers. And so there was another corridor that went right out of Alaska, right down the Yukon, right out into the eastern side of the Rockies, and right into Montana, and this was the other major migration route. So these are the ways that people came into this area. Three distinct racial groups came out of that. Two are old groups. And they may be the last members of those particular genetic families left on Earth because they evolved into something else in Asia. Some of the Indian peoples are racial types that are so old they exist nowhere else in the old world anymore. Also, a new racial group evolved in the New World, in Latin America, in South America. And then, about 23,000 years ago, things warm up again, rain is flooded, and beginning about 16,000 years ago and running to about 12,000 years ago, Varangia, things cool off again, Varangia is high and dry, and at that time, true Mongols, true northern Sinodont, Asiatic peoples, two of them, one are arboreal Mongols from northern China, from Manchuria region, move into North America. Today they speak the Athabascan languages, and we know them as Apaches and Navajos and Dene's in Alaska, and they spread out quite a bit from the Yaquis in Mexico to most of all of the Indians in Alaska. And then the other group were already specialized Arctic dwellers, and they were so talented, skilled, savvy about life that they were able to survive in an environment where there was no previous human population. They moved in and successfully multiplied their numbers in one of the harshest environments in the world. And these are the people who now call themselves Inuit and Inuit and Inui. And these are the Eskimos. And the interesting thing about them is that they've circled the entire world. This people moved west as far as Norway. They moved all the way across into Alaska and into the Canadian Arctic, into Greenland. And when Eric the Red landed in Iceland, there were ruins of Eskimo fishing camps on the beach. Kralings, he called them. So they've circled the entire northern part of the world with a unique culture and a consistent genetic heritage all the way around. And these were the other true Mongol people. They're called Arctic Mongols. That's what the scientists say. That's the definition of Indian that they're dealing with now. And like I say, it obviously breaks a few stereotypes. We always think of them as a single race, and now we have five races on our hands. Oh well, life in the big city. Now, the government. All of that's nice in a book. And what grandmother says about the Iroquois migrating up the Mississippi from the southwest, and all of this is wonderful native history, even if none of the anthropologists believe it. Grandmother believes it. But when it comes down to living, what matters is what Uncle Sam believes. And it's the same in Canada, it's the same in Latin America. And one of the critical problems is Indians don't have the right in any country of the Northern Hemisphere to define themselves. Indians do not have the right to decide who's Indian. Okay? That went with their sovereignty. Canada's definition is interesting in a couple of ways. Up there, the Indians, we've got to realize that Canada has stages of growth. French Canada became known as Lower Canada when the British conquered it. And essentially, they never really became a heavy, British people never became a heavy population there. Well, there were a lot of Catholic Scots and Catholic Irish who were already settled in Quebec when the English invaded. In fact, they've been chased out of Scotland and out of Ireland to get away from the English, and the English just caught up with them. So the Catholic population of Lower Canada was not purely French, ever. They were Celts who had moved in that area. When the English came on board, they negotiated treaties. The treaties were with the Crown, and those treaties are still sovereign agreements to this day. And one of the nice things about the British is they never went back and renegotiated any one of them. So whatever was in those treaties originally is still true. Now the United States has a record of going to the Cherokee, for example, and negotiating 36 treaties every 10 years and they wanted a little bit more land, they came back and renegotiated. But the British didn't do that. They were much more consistent. However, Lower Canada is one area, Upper Canada is now what we call Ontario, and then everything west of that was not part of Canada at that time. It was Rupert's Land. Now, Rupert's Land was governed by the Hudson's Bay Company, which had a charter from the British Crown going back to 1677. Hudson's Bay Company is the oldest company in the world today. In Canada, we talk about HBC, meaning here before Christ. Anyway, Hudson's Bay Company negotiated treaties on behalf of the company with the Indian tribes. When Queen Victoria decided in 1865 to give sovereignty to Canada in the sense that it would elect its own prime minister, and Upper and Lower Canada would, and they would have their own parliament, it did not affect the rest of what we call Canada. That was still going to be governed by something called a governor general. And the governor general would still answer directly to the crown. The trouble is, these earlier Indians had no treaties with the crown. They had treaties with the company. And so they all went out the window. In Western Canada, you have to be, by Canadian law today, since the provinces basically moved west and became part of Canada. By the way, the governor general still rules as the representative of the crown in all the Northwest Territories and the Yukon Territory of Canada. Only the provinces have representation in the parliament. The Victorian attitude was, okay, it's obvious to know who's an Indian. You're an Indian, if you have a treaty or no treaty, we'll work out some agreement with you. Non-treaty Indians have it tough, treaty Indians have at least a basic legal definition. But what about all them Métis? The British answer to it was simple. It was sexist. If your mother was white and your father was Indian, that kid's Indian. If your father was white and your mother was Indian, that kid's white. There are no mixed bloods. Okay, that was the Victorian British answer to the problem of the mixed bloods. By the way, they went one step farther. If a white woman married an Indian man, she became a member of the tribe. Likewise, if an Indian woman married a white man, she gave up her tribal citizenship. She could not hand down her enrollment and any of her privileges, if she had a treaty, to her children. Okay? So to marry across the bloodlines with a kiss of death, in the sense of your Indian rights or your citizenship, that's another factor too. In Canada, if you're an enrolled tribal member, you cannot vote as a citizen of the Dominion of Canada. They never mixed up Indian citizenship with national citizenship. You can't be both in Canada. Okay? Now, this obviously, when you look at the United States, brings up a whole lot of things. One of the big can of worms we did was we have these treaties with our own citizens. And a treaty is always between one sovereign country and another sovereign country. And how can your own citizens be sovereigns of another country? So when American government decided to give citizenship to Indians in a variety of ways, but essentially the Indian Citizenship Act was in the eight, was first of all came about as part of the Dawes Act. Any Indian who got land as of 1886 or before on an allotment and had settled down and lived in a house like a white person and had farmed his 40 acres the way the government wanted him to, became a citizen. Any Indian who didn't was not a citizenship until 1924. We made women citizen and then citizens, and then the government felt guilty. Well, who's left? Oh, there's a few Indians out there that aren't citizens yet. So they were the last ones, the ones who hadn't taken allotments on their reservations, were the last Americans to be given citizenship. But then what do you do with these treaties? The result of that has been a lot of trouble. And the troubles come about from basically two issues. If you're an Indian by whatever definition, and the government recognizes you as one, you've got this contract with the government. And even if you're not sovereign anymore according to the government, you're the heir to the contract. And then some of those contracts were written as perpetual agreements. I teach a lot of Indian kids who go to public schools. But because their ancestors signed a treaty which said that the government would provide free education for them, even before there was public education in the United States, because the government wanted to educate them to become white people, even if they move off the reservation, they still are entitled to special services from the federal government. We have a whole major funding system called Title IV Part A, which was part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and essentially Indians who no longer lived in reservations said, now wait a minute, we have all this assistance to help tutors and so on and so forth, to help our kids in schools if we live on the reservation, but we're no less the heirs to those treaties if we move off. And so the government said, you're right, and part of the Civil Rights Act was to create funding for special services for Indian kids in public schools off the reservations. If they're on the reservation, they call it Johnson O'Malley. They run educational programs on reservations. And the BIA has boarding schools, too. As you can see, it gets confusing. It gets terribly confusing. My daughter, blonde and blue-eyed, is eligible for Title IV assistance. Crazy as it seems. And yet she's not eligible to enroll. I'm the last one who can. So who's an Indian? What's an Indian? It isn't simple. Not to anybody.